You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
All right, it's true. I can't handle the truth. Friends and family are losing their jobs and their self-respect. Even German billionaires are throwing themselves under the trains.
This is the Radio Eco Shock Show with Alex Smith.
It used to be so easy here out on the edge. Nobody took the truth seriously. Economic doomsayers were just nuts then. Now, well, they dominate primetime TV. In last week's Radio EcoShock show, I did a feature on tools for tough times. Now I open up a blog on Wired magazine, and they do the same thing, except their list includes an Apple iPod instead of my axe and shovel. In just a few minutes, we're going to three features on the biofuel mess. I know how boring that sounds. That's what I thought, too. Then I get audio that turns our cozy green vision right upside down. It seems the big agribusiness corporations couldn't make enough monopolizing the world's food production. They decided to become energy giants, too. Wearing green overcoats, they stomped into the last remaining reserves of biodiversity, hacking it all down to grow palm oil and the soybeans we displaced with corn ethanol. Did I mention this great green rush may have caused the hottest year on record in 1998? You'll hear how tiny Indonesia passed the world's largest carbon polluters, including the United States, in a climate-tipping tsunami of greenhouse gases, an orgy of emissions. We'll hear voices from the Amazon and Asia, where biodiesel production has replaced food for indigenous people. And Dr. David Pimentel of Cornell University explains how we use a gallon and a half of ordinary oil to produce a gallon of ethanol. It's just a bubble, folks, a magic machine that transmutes oil into taxpayer subsidies and dead zones on the coasts. President Bush made so-called biofuels boom. What could go wrong? First, I want to get you a bit of news that gets buried. Here's a surprise. Carbon emissions to the atmosphere are still going up. Last summer, Kevin Anderson from the Tyndall Center told a stunned conference that carbon dioxide emissions were rising faster than anybody predicted or feared. He thought it improbable that levels could be kept to 650 parts per million, the doomsday scenario. That means at least a 4-degree centigrade rise average, and likely the tipping point at which ancient climate-shifting mechanisms take over. I'll get back to all that in a minute. Governments are doing absolutely nothing about it. Two European groups, German Watch and Climate Action Europe, have measured the Climate Change Performance Index. It shows which countries are actually trying to save the climate. Sweden, Germany, and France are top in the ranks, while the U.S. comes in 58th. U.S. emissions are up 20% since 1992. Canada's are up more than 26%. Canada is the 59th worst performing country, second only to Saudi Arabia at 60th. On the positive side, some OPEC countries are cutting oil production, trying to get prices back up. But the drop isn't enough to stop spiraling carbon emissions. Still, Goldman Sachs analysts say the low price of oil may halt development on expensive sources like Brazil's Tupi, billed as the largest oil find in the Americas since 1976. Also endangered are other deepwater drilling projects around the world, including one off Angola. Development of Canada's oil sands is also slowing, but not stopped. The Norwegian companies Statoil Hydro and Royal Dutch Shell have put off investments in Canada's tar sands. Aw, too bad. There's a lot of debate about the cooler weather in the Northern Hemisphere this year. Climate deniers say, well, that's it, it's the coming ice age. I just saw Lou Dobbs on the infamous CNN looking very wise. As he explained, the melting glaciers around the world are not from us, but from sunspot activity, a theory long ago thrown out by scientists who investigated it thoroughly. Television loves the car ads so much, they'll spit out anything. To show the depth of interdependence of television and auto advertising, here is a clip from a press conference given by the National Auto Dealers Association.
Chrysler President Jim Press reminding local television reporters even their jobs are at risk if Congress doesn't okay this multi-billion dollar bridge loan.
Who'd buy the advertising for you to be standing here taking pictures? The auto industry is the majority buyer of advertising in America, the capillaries in the economy worldwide.
Get it? If the big three go bankrupt and the Asian companies can't afford to advertise, commercial television networks may disappear. What a shame that would be. Think of the propaganda we'd miss. Oh, wait, the government would nationalize TV, too. Knock out the middleman, those wise corporate heads like Rupert Murdoch, and, well, get your government pablum directly. Although non-commercial stations worked out sort of okay in the UK, Canada, and other countries, it's not the end. At least you don't get 10 minutes of commercials every half hour. Back to the winter storms. We don't really know what caused this burst. It is compatible with scientific predictions in one way. The appearance of extreme precipitation events can appear as rain, or if the temperature is cold enough, as snow. It's happening now. Most of the media is blaming the storms on the appearance of the Pacific Ocean cooling phenomenon known as La Niña. Last April, NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab rats announced that the Pacific has entered a 10-year cool phase after 29 years of warmer currents. The ocean has oscillated between those states for a very, very long time. The combination of La Niña with warmer currents in the Atlantic may lead to drying in parts of the South America and the American Southwest, but more rain and flooding in the Pacific. Planting in Indonesia, Malaysia, and the Philippines could be affected. Weather instability may add to growing world hunger. Our friend on Climateer Investor Blog says, folks, maybe we should start thinking about rebuilding our grain reserves. My thoughts, exactly. Despite the snowstorms in North America and Europe, 2008 ended up in the top 10 warmest years, according to various climate centers. Remember, we are talking about the global average temperature, which includes the other hemisphere we so seldom hear about. Even here in Vancouver, we had one of the warmest Novembers on record. 2008 is likely one-tenth of a degree cooler than last year. Back when Bill Clinton was inaugurated, the 2008 average of 57.9 degrees would have been the warmest year on record. That shows you how far we've come.
Our duty to the human race is clear.
As you heard in our two interviews last week, papers presented at the American Geophysical Union conference in December show climate change is hard upon us, no matter what the doubters say. Here are two clips from a speech by Dr. Graham Pearman of Australia.
We got a big surprise after the IPCC report last year when the aerial extent of sea ice decreased in 1 year by 20%. That was not projected. But the biggest surprise is that all the five-year ice and older, all of the old ice, the thick, resilient ice, is gone. This led the Ice and Snow Institute in Boulder, Colorado, to conclude in May that there was not a zero probability that we would lose all the ice this year, whereas the IPCC report last year said it would occur most probably in 2050. Now, I'm not trying to scare people. I want you to realise we don't know everything, and we have to manage the risk that, in fact, these changes could take place much more quickly than we anticipated. The first issue, and you should be clear from the science slides that I've just shown you, that not everywhere on the planet is going to be impacted the same. And in fact, not in every area of the planet are we as certain as we are in other areas of what is going to happen. So it's a very inequitable distribution of likely impacts. As has been pointed out, there are people leaving island nations now, not in 20 or 30 years' time now, because the sea level's already gone up and destroyed their fresh water supply. So exposure to some of these things is now earlier for some people. It'll be very inequitably shared across the planet. The second thing, as is pointed out, that we all contribute to this very differently. And if you believe some people who are trying to lay action on this, Australia's contribution is insignificant. We actually emit 550 million tonnes of carbon dioxide a year. The UK emit 750, not a lot of difference. Canada 850, France 450. All of these nations actually emit about the same. They can all put up their hand and say we won't do anything until someone else does it. It isn't a sensible way to look at this particular issue. Of course, the US and China are around about 6,000, and what they do is important, although some of you all read recently that some of the states now are taking some very proactive action in the US, independent of their federal government. But the third point about this is that some of us are wealthy relative to the rest. And therefore we are going to be able to cope with some of this change better than others. So it is, as was pointed out, this combination of exposure being related to people who actually have very poor capabilities economically to really be able to cope with it. My own view, I think, is that this is going to be the hardest part of climate change to deal with. Dealing with these inequities in a world in which so much of our decision-making is really quite selfish. And I think that that's really what this the next couple of presentations will be about. How do we treat the reality of this science, given its certainties and uncertainties, in the framework of actually supporting the developing world and the movement towards a more equitable world? Thank you.
Find his presentation in Australia last summer on YouTube. Search for Pearman, P-E-A-R-M-A-N, and climate. A growing chorus of scientists think it is already too late to save the climate as we know it. Unless humans take over management of the atmosphere, that is geoengineering, my friends. One of the biggest worries, the Earth's covering of ice is disappearing. You have seen the comparison photos of various glaciers all around the world retreating or disappearing altogether. Even Glacier National Park may have no glaciers in just a few years. It's amazing. But now a NASA satellite can measure the loss of ice in places like Greenland and the Antarctic. The GRACE satellite is actually a pair of instruments which can determine changes in the mass below. As reported by RawStory.com, the latest data shows, quote, over 2 trillion tons of ice has melted since 2003. That's the headline to Google. The Environment News Network has the story as well. NASA geophysicist Scott Luthke told them, more than half of the loss of landlocked ice in the past 5 years has occurred in Greenland, based on measurements of ice weight by NASA's GRACE satellite. There have been many signs that Greenland is melting, instant lakes on top in summer, rumblings the size of earthquakes. Now we know for sure. The world's largest supply of ice on land is melting fast. It guarantees the sea level will rise, going way up, endangering major cities and crop deltas. Changes to climate and ecosystems as far away as the U.S. Southwest or even Australia could result from the loss of Arctic ice. The process may be irreversible. Here's a human side of that debate in a curious setting. One of the world's top climate scientists and modelers is Stephen Schneider of the U.S. A couple of years ago, Schneider found out he had a rare and deadly form of cancer. With little hope from existing treatments, he decided to apply the decision and risk models from climate to his own medical case. That resulted in a new approach to aggressive maintenance for cancer rather than a cure, and it has kept him alive so far. Here's a quick clip from Schneider's YouTube video, which is a 68-minute comparison of risk decisions for the world's climate and for himself as a man with deadly cancer. It turns out there are many parallels between his disease and ours.
So this is what Dr. Goy said. No standard therapy. Mantle cell lymphoma is the non-Hodgkin's with the worst outcome. I had to get it, right? No currently available curative therapy. Absolutely. So if you can't cure it, manage it. Risk management. Remember the risk management that I said about climate? You can't cure it. It's already too late. So let's manage it so we don't get the top end. Let's get the slots narrower that are really bad.
If you get time to visit this 68-minute video, you will appreciate why we need the mind of Stephen Schneider to keep us going. Over in Britain, the former head of the IPCC and now chief scientist for the UK Environment Department warns the world needs to prepare for a 4-degree centigrade rise in global temperatures. That means get ready for millions upon millions of climate refugees, countless climate-caused deaths, and possibly extreme shortages of food and water. Watson said, quote, we must alert everybody that at the moment we're at the very top end of the worst case scenario. I think we should be striving for 450 parts per million, but I think we should be prepared that 550 parts per million is a more likely outcome, end quote. Australia economist Ross Garnaut, hired by the government, also predicts future climate agreements will struggle to accept 550 parts per million as a goal. In Britain, the Independent newspaper carried an article on January 2, 2009 titled, Climate Scientists, It's Time for Plan B. They continue with the subheadline, Poll of International Experts by the Independent Reveals Consensus that CO2 cuts have failed and their growing support for technological intervention, end quote. Just like Steven Schneider, some scientists are now calling for a maintenance mode. They want geoengineering projects on a mass scale to protect us against the worst heating until we can transition our energy economy to some safe and renewable sources. Good God, we're back to fertilizing the oceans with algae blooms, as Russ George tried to do with planktos, or spraying ocean water into the air to create more cloud cover. Hopefully, the idea of launching a billion tiny reflective mirrors into space has died a quiet death. Anyway, the Independent newspaper surveyed 80 international climate scientists and found that 54%, quote, agreed that the situation is now so dire that we need a backup plan that involves the artificial manipulation of the global climate to counter the effects of man-made emissions of greenhouse gases. About 35% of respondents disagreed with the need for a Plan B, arguing it would distract from the main objective of cutting CO2 emissions, with the remaining 11% saying they didn't know whether geoengineering strategy is needed or not, end quote. I've heard these rumors and I've had emails from anxious scientists, but I didn't realize that more than half of them now favor geoengineering. Politics has failed. Our own social network has failed. We haven't really changed. The corporate system has failed. We are killing off the climate that supports us while continuing to shop at the mall. We still hope for a new car or a vacation getaway. Okay, we need a little less of this. And a little more of this. Our Radio EcoShock special on the biofuel scam and how it warms the world while talking green.
I'm going to give you a story of the biofuel madness in sort of, you know, in a very short manner.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. And we're going to investigate a wildly underreported climate disaster. A small country became the largest single source of greenhouse gases in the world, bar none. Indonesia's tropical forests were burned down to provide supposedly green alternative energy. Dr. Ted Padzek, spelled P-A-D-Z-E-K, is a professor of geoengineering at UC Berkeley, an expert on unconventional oil supplies. Previously employed by Shell Oil, Padzek has analyzed world energy supplies. He also knows a lot about chemical reactors, the devices that convert plant matter to fuels and other useful chemicals. We'll hear some clips from his presentation at Confronting the Triple Crisis Conference, held September 14th to 16th in Washington, D.C. The audio comes via the Progressive Underground hit program Unwelcome Guest, hosted by Lynn Gary. You can get Padzek's full speech, plus two more from the conference, as free MP3 downloads at our website, ecoshock.org. Choose alternative energy from the audio on demand menu.
Why are we doing biofuels? And actually, I should call them agrofuels. Well, there are three stated reasons to do so. The first reason, especially relevant for the United States, is energy security. The second reason is abatement of greenhouse gas emissions. And of course, there's a third reason, which is mentioned very often in Europe, and that is sustainable transportation. Of course, the industrial agrofuels fulfill none of these goals. They provide a false sense of security, of energy security. The greenhouse gas emissions associated with major agrofuel systems may be a factor of 10 higher than burning petroleum outright. And then finally, all major agrofuel systems are unsustainable directly, but they also cause large indirect damage in other places. So, for example, U.S. corn displaces U.S. soybeans into the Amazon forest. So while U.S. corn is polluting the drainage basin of the Mississippi River here, it is also causing indirect damage to the tropical forest in Brazil.
Dr. Padzek relates a climate disaster in 1997 and 98 that is still unknown to most of us here in the developed world.
In particular, in Indonesia, there is a pretty bad aspect of burning the forest to open land for agrofuel plantations, and that's peat. There are thick layers of underlying peat in the forest, which store perhaps 10 times more carbon than the forest itself. Once you start burning peat, you will release gigantic amounts of CO2 and other greenhouse gases. So, in fact, if you step even further out from the surface of the planet and you use, let's say, the polar orbiting satellite, you will then, you might witness a completely catastrophic event, an El Nino event in the fall of 1997-98, when roughly a tenth of all forest in Indonesia was burned by logging / oil palm plantation companies to open land for the plantations. This event had a truly global reach and catastrophic consequences, not only for Indonesia, but for the rest of us.
Can a burning Asian forest erupt in a carbon storm strong enough to trigger the famous warm currents and hot storms of El Nino? This is a claim I have not heard before. I did know that Indonesia, with a relatively small land mass, suddenly became the third largest carbon-emitting country in the world, behind only the United States and China. Now Tad Padzek computes that carbon from the peat forests topped the pollution from the biggest industrialized countries. Obviously, we have focused too much on SUVs while letting the cause of tropical forests slip below the radar of activism.
If you look at the amount of CO2 that was measured to be released in the region in the outset here, the Southeast Asia region, there were many stations that are measuring CO2 concentrations in the air. And if you plot this CO2 concentration versus time and you integrate, you take the area underneath the spike here, the amount of CO2 released from that single El Nino event was larger than the United States releases in 1 year. And the United States is the largest polluter of the atmosphere on the planet. So when people tell you about the clean palm oil biodiesel, think twice.
Beyond the disaster of palm oil, which displaces the great carbon sinks in Asian forests and elsewhere, we are always told of the holy grail of biofuels, cellulosic energy. Basically, that means being able to get oil substitutes from almost any plant matter using chemical reactors. The process could use forest industry waste, agricultural waste, or just ground-up greenery from nature. It all becomes grist for the big energy gulp.
Now, there are some facts about ecosystem productivity. First of all, plants or autotrophs use up about half of what they produce to live. Then animals, fungi, and bacteria eat up to 95% of the remainder. So on average, there is zero left. Of course, in our agricultural systems, we take out a lot of mass from the system every year, so we have to replenish them and subsidize them with ancient plant matter as fossil fuels and minerals.
Is cellulosic energy the green answer, or another unnatural disaster in the making? First of all, almost all of the cellulosic plants are just that. So far, with the exception of one plant in Canada, Padzek tells us, cellulosic technology is imaginary. The Canadian plant managed to get 20% efficiency, that is, 5 parts energy input yields 1 part out. The average efficiency of the best corn refineries is 37%. The industry claims much higher by including the value of a distilled byproduct, but the aim here is energy, and 37% is the best they can do. Even converting coal to liquid fuels gets only 42%, Padzek says. By contrast, an average U.S. oil refinery gets 88% efficiency. Almost all of the energy input becomes a useful product. Dr. Padzek emphasizes that no so-called biofuel source can come anywhere close to the end-use energy production of oil itself. That, in my opinion, has serious warnings for our future. No technology for replacing oil and gas, on the scale now used for transportation and heating and fertilizers and chemicals, none of that exists. Trying to plug that gap as peak oil develops with biofuels becomes a nightmare of impossible proportions. In fact, that nightmare has arrived. Each of us is already consuming much more energy than all the plant life of Earth can provide. Here's Professor Padzek.
The next stage now is to go to the so-called cellulosic ethanol, that is to utilize entire plants and convert them into liquid fuels, let's say using fermentation, decomposition and fermentation of cellulose. You will see that the eastern part of the United States, most of India, China, Middle East, some of Indonesia, in fact are using up between 50 to 200% of what the plants can produce. Now, obviously, Sahara isn't producing much, neither is the interior of Australia. So the only other places where we can go and grab some of the productivity of which we haven't grabbed is the Amazon, is the equatorial Africa, and some of the Southeast Asia, because as you will see, the rest of it actually uses up already a lot of its existing net primary productivity. So the bottom line is this, that Mother Earth does not have anything to spare to us. And all the stock that we can take mass forever is just that, talk. I will give you a very quick rundown on the numbers of how much energy can be produced by plants in the United States. I will use a somewhat different unit, one exajoule, which is essentially the amount of energy in food, which when digested will feed 300 million Americans for 1 year and feed us rather well. Okay? And so that's my fundamental unit. Currently, the United States, as David alluded to, uses about 105 times more energy than we need to live. We should cut it down to by a factor of 2 to align us with Western Europe, and then by another factor of 2, while the Europeans are doing their best, to align us with the capabilities of the planet Earth. By the way, if we were to eat this amount of energy, each one of us would be a 40, 45 ton, seven-story high bull sperm whale. So look at yourselves and imagine yourself to being this huge giant trampling the earth, and that's who we are.
Using NASA satellite mapping and sophisticated calculations of the plant mass growing in the United States, for example, all the farms, the forests, and the wildlands, it would take 64% of that total, ground up and fermented at 32% efficiency, just to provide a third of the fuels used now in America. We could bulldoze every living thing and still run out of fuel. The message from Berkeley Professor Tadzik is stark and simple. If your future is running on plant-based ethanol, you are dreaming of catastrophic failure. Get the full talk in the energy section at ecoshock.org. Here is Lynn Gary, host of Unwelcome Guest, with your wrap-up info.
You've been listening to a panel on false solutions from Confronting the Triple Crisis, a conference convened last September in Washington, D.C. by the International Forum on Globalization. For more information, visit ifg.org. You can download an MP3 of this and previous episodes of the show at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.
Next on Radio EcoShock, Cornell's Dr. David Pimentel will explain the cruel idiocy of burning corn for car fuel. Then the radio premiere from the Canadian National Film Board, you'll hear voices from the Global South where biofuels displace local humans and nature's last reserves. Coming to you in 30 seconds. Here's a bit contributed by Sylvanus, the Montreal artist, goddess of the earth.
Man of the goddess of the earth, man better know what they are worth. More than money or anything you think, it is source of life. A woman of the link, if it wasn't for them, would all be extinct. The balance of
of life who be resting on the brink. Them rocking up here equally with food. Don't deliver this, young man, don't be rude. To this mama earth, no excuse. With a goddess by my side, how can I lose? All right then, woman of the goddess of the earth. Goddess of the earth, goddess of the earth. All right then, woman of the goddess of the earth. Man better know what they are worth.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex. We're going on an audio trip to the Big Green Detour to the false promises of biofuels. Later we'll hear voices from the South, but right now, Dr. David Pimentel quickly laments the $5 billion fuel fiasco in America. Courtesy of Alternative Radio, unwelcome guest.
You're listening to a panel on false solutions to the problem of energy from Confronting the Triple Crisis, a conference held last September in Washington, D.C. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia.
Our first speaker that we're going to have will be Dr. David Pimentel. And Dr. Pimentel is from Cornell University. He's a professor of ecology and agricultural sciences. His PhD is from Cornell, a postdoctoral study at Oxford University and University of Chicago. And his research spans the fields of energy, biotechnology, sustainability, and international agriculture, land and water conservation, ecological and economic aspects of pest control, and environmental policy. He's published more than 600 scientific papers and 24 books. He served on many national and government committees, including National Academy of Sciences, President's Science Advisory Council, U.S. Department of Energy, and many more. So please welcome Dr. David Pimentel. Thanks.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction, and I'm extremely pleased to be here and to share with you some of my ideas and concerns. I put this first slide on, showing all of these people, because this is what our major problem is, in fact, that we have too many people for the energy resources, for the food resources, land, water, and so forth, to provide everyone with their needs. And the next this slide indicates the total number of people on Earth today, which is more than 6.5 billion, and we add a quarter of a million, and I emphasize that, we add a quarter of a million additional people every 24 hours. And the World Health Organization reports that we already have 3.7 billion people who are malnourished on Earth. This is nearly 60% of the world's population are malnourished on Earth. And it does relate to this whole question of biofuels. Now, we in the U.S. are blessed with an abundance of a variety of foods. And we eat, in fact, too much. The average American consumes 2,200 pounds of food per person per year, or close to 1,000 kilograms per person per year. And that is, in fact, one of our major problems. Now, relative to this collection of solar energy for biofuels, ethanol in particular, our green plants collect only 0.1% of the solar energy reaching the plants during the year. And to put that into perspective, photovoltaics, for example, collects approximately 20%, or in fact, photovoltaics collects 200 times the solar energy that our green plants, and I'm not being critical of green plants, they've been around for billions of years. Now, also to put into perspective this issue, back in 1850, we were primarily dependent on wood as our primary fuel. And in fact, we had shortages of wood way back in 1850. And I put on this slide to provide you also with a perspective that we're overusing resources in the United States. The bar on your left indicates the quantity of fossil energy that we use annually in the United States, which is approximately 100 quads, and a quad has 10 to the 15th BTUs, but that's not crucial. The bar on your right indicates the quantity of solar energy captured by all the green plants in the United States. I mean all of agriculture, all of forestry, all of grasses, lawns, and so forth. We are burning or using twice as much fossil energy per year in the U.S. than the green plants collect annually in the U.S. And again, that's all of agriculture, forestry, and so forth. And we can't continue to do that. Now, first of all, of course, to produce corn ethanol, you have to grow the corn. And it takes 14 different energy inputs to produce an acre of corn. And roughly, it takes about 100 gallons of oil equivalents to produce an acre of corn. It's really quite energy intensive. And also, it takes approximately 22 pounds of corn to produce 1 gallon of ethanol. That 22 pounds of corn, of course, is food that we are putting in our gas tanks and so forth, and that has the implications that I mentioned early. To produce 1 gallon of ethanol that's taken this 22 pounds of corn requires about 28,000 kilocalories. 28,000 kilocalories is approximately 1 gallon of gasoline. So it's taking 1 gallon of gasoline to produce 1 gallon of ethanol. Now, when you're through the fermentation, that is, taken the corn, ground it, and put the yeast in to ferment this corn, you end up with, and after you've distilled the ethanol out of the water, and incidentally you have 10% ethanol and 90% water, and it takes a lot of energy to get that ethanol out of the water and concentrate it. In any case, you can't burn 95% ethanol if you're going to mix it with gasoline. You have to further energy inputs to concentrate that ethanol into 99.5% so that you can mix it with gasoline, and that takes more energy. Now, then I looked at the energetics of this, and I told you earlier that for every gallon of ethanol that you produce requires 28,000 kilocalories. And the 28,000 kilocalories, as I mentioned earlier, is about 1 gallon of gasoline. The energy in 1 gallon of gasoline. A gallon of ethanol has 19,400 kilocalories present in it. So, in fact, it's taken 40% more energy to produce that gallon of ethanol than we actually are getting out. Or another way to look at it, it takes 1.5 gallons of gasoline to produce 1 gallon of ethanol. A definite cost in trying to produce ethanol using corn. Now, you will see, in fact, many publications that are talking about the positive return we get when we do produce ethanol, and the way that these pro-ethanol people are able to achieve a positive return is that they omit the farm labor, they omit farm machinery, they omit irrigation, they omit the energy required to produce the hybrid corn and various other, and they omit the environmental impacts that I'll tell you about in a moment, and then take excess credit after you get through converting the corn into ethanol. You have a byproduct left called distiller's grain that you can feed to cattle. But distiller's grain is not energy in the terms that you can put it into your gas tank. And so, but they're taking credit for all of this so that they can make ethanol look like a winner. And but the environmental impacts are enormous. It takes approximately 1,700 gallons of water to produce 1 gallon of ethanol. Most of that is in the growing of the corn. Now, corn production causes more soil erosion than any other crop grown in the nation. It uses more nitrogen fertilizer than any other crop grown in the nation. And in fact, the nitrogen that is leaking from our corn production is going down the Mississippi into the Gulf of Mexico, and it's the prime cause of the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico that's the size of New Jersey. Then corn production uses more insecticides than any other crop, more herbicides than any other crop grown, and these two pesticides are causing major environmental impacts. And then in the production of ethanol, it releases enormous quantities of carbon dioxide, contributing to the global warming problem. First of all, I told you that it takes 1.4 gallons of gasoline equivalents to produce a gallon of ethanol, and so you've added more carbon dioxide there. But number two, in the fermentation process, that is, when the yeasts are fermenting the corn to produce ethanol, they release enormous quantities of carbon dioxide. So you've got two major sources of carbon dioxide being released from this ethanol production. And then when ethanol is burned in the car, ozone and various other pollutants are released into the atmosphere and cause human problems as well as other environmental problems. Well, that's a shot of soil erosion. And then for every gallon of ethanol that is produced, there are 12 gallons of sewage effluent that have to go into the sewage system. And this is a major environmental cost. Now, in the U.S. today, and I'm using DOE or Department of Energy numbers, last year we produced 5 billion gallons of ethanol, which certainly sounds like a lot of fuel. However, and it took 20% of U.S. corn to make this ethanol. And then you ask the question, what does 5 billion gallons of ethanol mean to total petroleum use in the United States? It's 1%. Is that making us oil independent? 1%. And then if we use 100% of U.S. corn to produce ethanol, it would provide us with 7% of our total petroleum use. In fact, if we used all the ethanol produced in Brazil, you'll hear about it in a moment, and all the ethanol produced in the United States, it would provide us with 2% of our total petroleum use. It's not saving us. Now, when we're converting corn into ethanol, we're taking corn away from livestock production, beef, pork, chickens, eggs, and so forth. And this is increasing the cost of food to you as well as the people in the world who depend on grains as their food. To produce ethanol, and the reason for ethanol production from corn in the United States, and actually in Brazil too, is subsidies. The government is subsidizing the production of corn ethanol, and it's costing $6 billion of your money, tax money, to produce this ethanol. And then you're paying an extra money, as I told you, for higher prices of meat, milk, and eggs. Now, then you ask, what does $6 billion in subsidies for ethanol mean relative to the subsidies for a gallon of ethanol? The subsidies for a gallon of ethanol are 90 times, and I want to emphasize that, are 90 times the subsidies per gallon of gasoline. I'm not for any subsidies, gasoline or ethanol. Now, good. the burning of corn has this ethical issue that I mentioned earlier, that there are 3.7 billion people who are malnourished on Earth. And the burning of corn, 22 pounds per gallon of ethanol, is, I think, a disaster in those terms. Anyway, it's higher meat, milk, and egg prices for us, but it's also affecting the poor people of the world.
David Pimentel. You've been listening to a panel on false solutions from Confronting the Triple Crisis. You can download an MP3 of this and previous episodes of the show at unwelcomeguests.org.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
You can't handle the truth!
What?
Citizenship, a social issues website and media platform produced by the National Film Board of Canada. These podcasts are independently created by people like you. Go to citizen.nfb.ca to contribute.
How many people have ever Googled biofuel and scan?
The complicated issue of using technologies to solve these problems is not as simple as it sounds.
Biofuels were precisely the kind of things that politicians loved. Simplistic solutions to complex problems that require little, if any, change to the status quo, at least for some.
Absolutely no public consultation. They kept saying they would, but they never did. So these companies, they don't care about local people.
The debate about biofuels also includes deforestation, human rights, labor conditions, and the impacts of monoculture agriculture.
I just want that you can imagine how in that beautiful land we are facing terrible things because the agro-food. But we love our land, so we are resisting every day.
Food versus fuel.
In the current context of peak oil, alternatives to a petroleum-based society are crucial. Agrofuels, also called biofuels, are offered as one of these solutions. Throughout North America and the European Union, governments and large-scale agriculture companies are promoting the use of agrofuels. And as oil becomes more scarce and costly, we are seeing a spike in crops for fuel, such as soybeans and African palm. However, it is important to examine the nuances of these so-called solutions. Agrofuels are being pushed by the same industrial giants and political perpetrators behind the energy crisis. And then they are greenwashed as an environmentally sound solution. Agrofuel production is ravaging communities and the land in some of the most bio and culturally diverse regions of the world, especially in South America. At a recent gathering in Brazil, farmers questioned the very usage of the term biofuels after they heard a long presentation about the development of large-scale fuel crops on indigenous land. The community members said bio means life, and they didn't see the biofuels industry respecting life. They said it should be called agrofuels. Devlin Kuyak is the Canadian representative of GRAIN, an international organization promoting the sustainable management of agricultural biodiversity based on people's control over genetic resources and local knowledge.
In Canada, we're just seeing the beginnings of this because a lot of the ethanol production, a lot of the biofuel production is just coming online, and it's going to be part of this mandate that the government is proposing, a 5% mandate where you'd have to have 5% of your transportation fuels coming from biofuels. And when that happens, we're going to see much more production coming online, so much more of the crops will be devoted to that. The problem is we're not going to see an expansion of much agricultural land in Canada. We've pretty much taken all that we can. So it's going to mean importing. So we're already a net importer of corn, which is going to be the main feedstock for ethanol. So we're going to be importing more. We're going to be importing more from the U.S. We're going to be importing more from Brazil, from South America. So expanding production, particularly in the south, and we've already been importing ethanol from Brazil. As we expand the mandate, that's naturally what's going to happen. It's going to mean that there we're going to be importing from where they can expand the land mass. And that's basically going to mean driving out the local food production in a lot of countries that still have that as their main source of food, driving people out, moving more people into the cities and taking over land so that they can export, you know, not this just time, this time food, but also fuels.
Argentina does not use biofuels at all. It's very, like, very particular cases, you know. There's been this objective of 5% legislated for 2010, but there is not a traditional use of, at least of biodiesel, you know. Just, we are mainly talking about biodiesel, not biofuels in general. So, and most of our energy comes from oil and from hydroelectric dams. So we are not looking at our own needs to whatever we are producing, but to the needs of other countries. And in general, there cannot be territory that colonially uses the resources of another territory to keep its way of living. No, we cannot export this American way of life as the perfect ideal for everywhere in the world, because it consumes the resources of other territories just to keep it up. And that's why we want to question the production of soy, as we would question the production of oil to export in Argentina. You know, Argentina used to be quite a diverse productive country. At some point, we really exported a lot of food to the world, and we used to have great amounts of wheat and of maize and of sunflower and other crops, no other food crops. And what happened is that the expansion of soy has displaced all these crops, and the prices of food have gone up easily. The local governments and provincial governments are the one giving out false land acts, false land titles, you know. And they are very much involved too in the soy production interests. And in general, you know, there's a very close link between the legal system locally and the political system. So, and usually those are very much linked to the, like, the highest class in the provinces. You know, we have a very sort of colonial system out in the countryside. So there's really nothing being done to address it from the legal point of view. There's been two or three endeavors that I think that are interesting. There's been a Native Forests Act that passed last year, which is a moratorium on deforestation. But most of these governments on the provinces where soy is the biggest issue are rejecting it and refuse to implement it. So just as an example of how this works. And there are some initiatives on land regulation, but still nothing happening. You know, it's really no man's land at some point.
According to Marilyn Machado, communities of Afro-Colombian descent are the most poor and marginalized communities within Colombia, a country in the midst of a decades-long civil war. Furthermore, these communities have experienced violent, forced displacement for oil palm plantations along the Pacific coast.
I live in a beautiful place in Colombia when we have a biological diversity, and we live in peace before the interests of the big companies about the agrofuels come to our land and begin to killing people and displace the people. So I think the difference between live in the north and living in the south is that I think you have many idea about consumption. It's like a devastated. You have a voracity for consumption, and we in the south just want to live appropriately in harmony with nature.
But the agri-fuels issue isn't exclusive to South America, nor bound by national borders. The omnipresence of fuel crops in world markets and in former rainforests has serious ramifications for food sovereignty across the globe, establishing a new nexus for resource-based conflict between the rich and poor, and between industrialized agriculture and small farmers. Susan Labchuk from Earth Action on Prince Edward Island explains.
Well, we all know about peak oil, but now people are starting to talk about peak soil. And that's because the industrial model of agriculture that we're using is mining the soil. And so a lot of places, the topsoil is lost, you know, to wind and rain and erosion. And increasingly, the planet is becoming a desert. I mean, there are places in China where there are, you know, thousands of square miles are becoming desert because of industrial agriculture and the chemicals and all that sort of thing. And we've also got problems with loss of arable land on a daily basis. The human population is increasing, and more humans means we need more houses, we need more roads, we need more places to build industry, places to dump our waste. And so we're losing arable land to that. And at the same time, as the population increases, we need more and more food. And at the same time, we're not only losing the soil, but the quality of the soil is decreasing as well from the chemical use. The biofuel industry is only going to make the problem that much worse, because it is just another industrial monoculture. So it's going to completely, you know, ruin whatever soil is left that they get their hands on. And a lot of it is very fragile tropical soils, and it's not going to last very long. I mean, we need to take a good hard look at what Plan B might possibly be. And Plan B means, what are we going to do when the fossil fuel gets so expensive we can't afford it? And not only in terms of agriculture, but of course all of our agriculture right now is completely and utterly based on fossil fuel. Not only the chemical inputs, but the machinery that's required, the long-range transportation, the processing of the food, all of that completely dependent on fossil fuel. Not to mention all of the other systems in place outside of agriculture. So if we don't start looking at how we are going to transition from this fossil fuel intensive lifestyle we have into whatever the future might bring, it's going to happen to us without any kind of pre-planning. And that we've already got an awful lot of social unrest and environmental catastrophes around the planet. Because of this, we don't see them as much in Canada, so we think that perhaps maybe that day will never come, but it is coming, it's inevitable, and we need to start looking at Plan B.
So what we're seeing is a major expansion in industrial monocultures, which is, you know, being talked about as a way to resolve an energy security problem, and that just dumps it into a food security problem. And so now we get a global food crisis, which is triggered in part by the production of biofuels. And it's never ending. You're going to have just one problem after the other, and the next solution, of course, will come from the very same corporations, and it will expand their profits, and that's exactly what we're seeing. We're seeing record profits from corporations in the middle of a food crisis. So it's a point of crisis right now, and that means that there's an opportunity, there's a moment that I think we have to reevaluate where we are, to go in a completely different direction, and to completely alter the current power structure that exists, because that's fundamentally what it's about. If we stay in the same power structure, we're going to get the same kind of solutions coming forward. And that has to be changed, and it's the only way to get out of it.
I think that my main message for you is that we need to live in a different way, because we, like human beings, don't have a right to devastate the nature, because the nature is the future of the new generation.
And that's it for Radio EcoShock this week. Find our website at ecoshock.org. Alex has left the building.
It's green, see? A green fix should last a long time.